This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with the former head of the ACLU of Southern California about the powers of the executive during times of emergency.
Under the U.S. Constitution, the three branches of government were supposed to be co-equal. Well, because the president is the commander-in-chief, he's got a little more power than the others, too. And now with the Declaration of Emergency Powers, he's got even more. That's what we're going to be talking about.
We anticipated a situation like this 1 year ago when we spoke with attorney Andrew Boyd.
Between Boyd, who is with the great Brennan Center in New York City, who gives us the background, and the update from Stephen Rohde, we're able to offer to you, our listeners, a comprehensive understanding of what it means when the president has emergency powers.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Michael, it's great to be talking to you via phone on Law and Disorder.
Yeah,
how
it certainly
you?
Is. I haven't seen you in weeks, Heidi, and I haven't seen you, Jeff. We should explain to people that we're doing our show remotely now. We used to all meet at our studio on 57th Street and 6th Avenue in Manhattan. Jeff would drive in on his motorcycle. Heidi would jump on the train. I would get on the F train from Brooklyn. And the guests would come in, and we would do the radio show. But these are not normal times, are they, Heidi?
They're not. And we'd first like to say that we hope all of our listeners are doing well, remaining calm and staying at home, and that we will give a host updates on what we observe to be civil liberties infractions as we all process what it's like to live in a pandemic.
We're going to continue doing this radio show. We're doing it remotely. Heidi from Manhattan, me from the Catskill Mountains. Keep tuning in because this show is going to continue on. We're just going to do it in a different way. Heidi, how are you doing personally?
I'm fine, Michael. Thank you for asking. I have been reading the newspaper and watching electronic media. And I wanted to mention, Michael, that as I'm sure listeners know by now, Trump has been referring to the COVID-19 coronavirus as the so-called Chinese virus. And he, as of last week when we recorded this, was continuing to defend his practice of referring it to that way, saying it's not racist and that that's where the virus originated in. He wants the Chinese to know that it's not from the U.S. military. And what do you think about that, Michael? It's really causing more racism.
I think the last guy in the country we would want to be the leader in a pandemic which threatens the lives of tens of thousands is Donald Trump. I think it's more of the same. We saw it when he campaigned against Mexicans. We see it now. It's divide and conquer. It's racism. It's nothing else.
Michael, I wanted to add that apparently Trump used this language in a message he emailed last week saying, quote, America is under attack, not just by an invisible virus, but by the Chinese. That was a campaign appeal, and then said at the end of it, what is Joe Biden up to as all this is happening? Siding with the Chinese and attacking the presidential candidate China fears most, Donald Trump. These kinds of statements, as you've mentioned, are just not helpful. And, you know, I work in Chinatown at the A.J. Mustey Institute, where we've seen a boycotting, as it were, of the Chinese restaurants before people started staying at home. It's very unfortunate.
No, as with everything else about Trump, everything comes down to him. The guy is just utterly narcissistic and self-centered, and he thinks that somehow this virus is designed to stop him politically. And what concerns me is that's exactly what he might do, and that's what we're going to do our show on. I remember Michael Cohen, his lawyer, testifying in front of Congress last year, and the last point that Cohn made was that you'll never get this guy out of office. He's just going to stay there. We're going to have that discussion with our two guests who are upcoming on what to do about that. I think what Malcolm X said after Kennedy was assassinated is that the chickens are coming home to roost. I think they certainly are with Trump, and with more than Trump, because the groundwork was laid for this 40 years ago with the onset of neoliberalism, which is really an extreme form of capitalism. I remember Margaret Thatcher saying there's no such thing as society, and Ronald Reagan agreeing with her. They were tight, and Reagan said, don't look to government to solve your problems. Government is the problem. Well, that's exactly wrong. And if we don't have a collective effort here, and our government is our collective being, if we don't have a collective effort here, this tragedy could be just enormous.
Well, Michael, I wanted to say that in Israel, just to go back to civil liberties issues a bit, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu recently announced via television that Israel would implement emergency cyber surveillance measures for a full month. And that means that authorities there will be tracking the mobile phones of people diagnosed with COVID-19, as well as those just suspected of having contracted it. They're going to use the information they collect to inform people who may unwittingly come in contact with those who are affected in the 2 weeks prior to confirming their cases for containment. Now, the technology they're going to be using was created for counterterrorism purposes, and Netanyahu actually bypassed their parliamentary process to implement that. And I think that we could see something like that in this country, because South Korea also is collecting extensive data, including using credit card use, location tracking, and they're doing that without a warrant, purportedly to prevent the disease. I'm curious to see what kind of monitoring this country might enlist over the next.
One of the things Trump can do now is to turn off the internet. He could pull the kill switch. He can also monitor the internet. He can decide what goes on. In fact, Facebook, which is working closely with the government, has already censored the internet. So when people put stuff up that Facebook doesn't like, they take it out. Even worse, I think, is Trump's power to send troops anywhere. So if things get really hairy, there are public demonstrations. Let's say there are demonstrations because there's a shortage of food, which is quite likely. Trump can send in troops to break up those manifestations. So it's not just control of the internet and how we can communicate with each other, but it's even control of the streets.
Michael, yes. The internet is clearly our lifeline right now as people are working from home. I understand that the European Commission has said that this added distribution of traffic is straining the internet infrastructure at a time when it's most crucially needed for healthcare services, online teaching, and all the many practices that we've seen going from in-person to virtual. And I think that, as you've alluded to, we all have a joint responsibility to ensure that the functioning of the internet continues during this pandemic.
One concluding thought. I think what we've seen demonstrated with this implosion of capitalism, the American government that is run by the American capitalists is the world's richest failed state. And just health-wise, they disbanded the committee that was supposed to fight pandemics on the grounds that they wanted to cut back on government. They cut back the budget for the CDC. And then, now that we have this pandemic upon us, you can't get a test to find out if you have it. There's no vaccine that's been developed to prevent it. There's no treatment for it. There's no room in hospitals, or there won't be any room in hospitals for it. There's not enough ventilators that have been manufactured to help people breathe. Why are there no ventilators? Why are there not enough? Because they cost about what a car costs, $25,000 to $50,000. And hospitals, which are run, most of them, on the basis of private profit, don't want to invest it because they're afraid if they buy ventilators at $50,000 apiece, they're going to be stuck with them after the pandemic is over with. So this is an implosion of American capitalism, particularly in the health industry. And like Malcolm X said, to repeat, chickens have come home to roost.
It's greed and lack of empathy for others that are really driving a lot of these problems.
The last point President Trump's former attorney, Michael Cohen, made when he testified last year before Congress was that Trump would never leave office voluntarily. With the pandemic of COVID-19 upon us, Trump has the perfect excuse. Last week, he declared a state of national emergency. This gives him over 100 additional powers. He can shut down the Internet, regulate the Internet. He's already banned gatherings of more than 10 people, and he can even send troops anywhere in the country. What is the current state of our civil rights and civil liberties? Without being alarmist, what do we have to fear? We speak today with California Attorney Stephen Rohde. Attorney Rohde is a constitutional scholar, lecturer, writer, political activist, and retired civil rights lawyer. He is a former president of the ACLU of Southern California and the chair of the ACLU Foundation of Southern California. Mr. Rohde is the author of two books, American Words of Freedom, The Words That Define Our Nation, and Freedom of Assembly, and he's the co-author of Foundations of Freedom, A Living History of Our Bill of Rights. He's written for the American Prospect, Truth Out, and the LA Times, and he's a frequent contributor to the Los Angeles Review of Books. Attorney Stephen Rohde, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Steve, due to the coronavirus, President Trump has declared a national emergency. What authority does this give him?
Well, this is a very dangerous situation. I'm not prone to exaggeration or being an alarmist, but I think everyone who's listening and who cares about our country and our Constitution needs to take very seriously the national emergency that President Trump has declared. He called himself a war president recently, and I don't think that's just a colorful phrase. Politically, I think he wants to see himself as a war president because war presidents often get reelected, and I think he is seeing himself in the setting of a war president, and these emergency powers give him tremendous authority. What he did last Friday was to invoke two different laws. He invoked the Stafford Act, and he invoked his powers under the National Emergency Act. And we can talk about both of those. The Stafford Act, which is really the Stafford Disaster Relief and Emergency Assistance Act of 1988, we hope will be used benignly and effectively. It really allows state and local governments to receive financial and physical assistance. And a lot of what President Trump is talking about these days are new powers and additional powers that he's invoking under the Stafford Act. The National Emergency Act is far more of concern. What it does, it gives him the power to invoke over 100 different provisions already in the law. We've got 33 other national emergency declarations already in place. So the president and all presidents in the last several decades have had vast powers, and the question is always, how are they going to use them? And I think the reason we can be very concerned, and the reason I'm glad you're devoting a segment to this, is because we have a track record with President Trump. We know how he views executive authority, so that's what's very concerning. We also still have in effect the February 2019 national emergency to build the wall on the southern border. That is still in effect. The problem with all these declarations is that they give broad power, and the president can activate those powers in ways that are not necessarily described in the National Emergency Declaration. So broadly, and we could talk about each of these in more detail, now the president has the power to shut down or control radio stations and communication stations. He has powers to freeze American bank accounts. He can limit international trade, and he can call out troops in various circumstances. So this is dangerous. And finally, when you combine the Stafford Act with the National Emergencies Act, when you combine two acts, he can also loosen regulatory restrictions on health care services. Now, in times, people are already applauding efficiencies and streamlining things, but we have to be very concerned for the health of the country, both constitutionally and medically, of how he's going to use these powers.
He's already the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. Does this make the executive branch stronger than its supposedly co-equal branches of the legislature and the Supreme Court?
Yeah, that's a dangerous aspect to this. Our Constitution, unlike other constitutions in the modern era, does not specify emergency powers in the executive branch. I think the founders were very worried, having come out of a monarchy. So, in fact, the strongest powers in emergencies, the Constitution rests with Congress. The Congress can suspend the writ of habeas corpus during invasion or rebellion and provide for calling forth the militia to execute laws of the Union and suppress insurrections and repel invasions. Those are powers in the hands of Congress. And once again, we're very fortunate that we have a divided Congress between the Democratic control in the House and the Republican control in the Senate. This could be far worse because those bodies could be passing additional powers to the executive. So the Constitution is relatively silent, but by practice and some analysis, the president is considered to have inherent emergency powers. These powers have been invoked in the past. Franklin Delano Roosevelt interned U.S. citizens and Japanese Americans in internment camps. And George Bush used warrantless wiretapping and torture after 9/11. All of that. And the much lauded Abraham Lincoln suspended the writ of habeas corpus, which he had no right to do. So we see examples of both using powers that are implied in the Constitution and, in some cases, violating the limits on executive power and going beyond those that authority. And that's what has to be troublesome.
Well, what does the Constitution say about all this with respect to protecting us against a president that overreaches?
Well, we do have our Constitution in place. And one of my messages today is, well, we all should be well informed about this, and later we can talk about what people and other elected officials can do. I think we have to recognize that we have a strong, robust Constitution. We're exercising it every day. You and I are exercising it today by freely being on the air and discussing these issues, at least for now. We have due process. We have various rights against unlawful incarceration. We have rights in the Sixth Amendment and Fifth Amendment and throughout the Bill of Rights. So I do want to emphasize the strength of the Constitution. In large part, it's worked over the last 3.5 years. But let's not forget that the Supreme Court, which we'll talk about in a moment, is now controlled by a conservative majority, including two justices appointed by President Trump. And if any of the issues we're talking about today are ever contested, if any of these powers are exercised and then challenged, ultimately they're going to get to the United States Supreme Court. And I am very concerned in the theory of the unitary executive that several of the justices believe in, which gives ultimate power to the president, I am not sanguine of how the Supreme Court would react.
Yeah, and neither am I. What do you make of the Supreme Court now with the addition of Gorsuch and Kavanaugh? They now have a majority. Are these people more inclined to authoritarianism?
Well, that's my concern. They've shown, they've exhibited signs of that so far in some of their rulings. They're using a process of enjoining lower court rulings that are against Trump while those rulings are being appealed. So they're immediately giving the government side a leg up. They do have to face some serious precedents in this area of executive authority. The Supreme Court has addressed these questions in the past, and they're going to have to confront those precedents. During the Truman administration, President Truman tried to take over steel mills during the Korean War. And in a very important case called Youngstown Steel and Tube Company versus Sawyer, the court invalidated President Truman's efforts at bold and broad exercise of executive power. And there are very important concurring opinions in that case, which suggest that the president's authority is at its lowest ebb when acting without congressional authority. But we also have dark periods in American history when it comes to the Supreme Court. We know that in Korematsu, in 1944, the Supreme Court upheld the internment of Japanese Americans under FDR's emergency powers. But there was a powerful dissent in that case by Justice Robert Jackson, who warned, and this warning we need to hear today, he warned that emergency powers lie about like a loaded weapon, ready for the hand of any authority that can bring forth a plausible claim of an urgent need. And I think we have to keep that in mind. So it's those kinds of precedents that I hope will limit what the Supreme Court does.
Yes, that's something that's extremely concerning, particularly when you have this virus that could strike anybody, anywhere. It's an instrument of fear. And I remember what President Nixon said when after he retired and a reporter asked him, what was the secret of your political success, President Nixon? And Nixon answered unhesitatingly, he said, it was fear. I used fear. And they don't teach you that in the Boy Scouts. And do you think that that's something that Trump is using now?
Oh, I think he is very adept at that. He's been using it regarding immigrants, regarding his opposition, regarding the free press. So this is a man who will stoop to use anything. And unfortunately, what happens when you have a genuine crisis, and nobody can suggest this is not an emergency in terms of public health and the economy. So we recognize there is a true emergency. The question is, how does a responsible leader exercise those powers? What some people don't know is that there is embedded in the FCC and the congressional powers, it's called Section 706, enacted back in 1942 in the Communications Act, to allow a president to shut down or take control of, quote, any facility or station for wire communications upon his proclamation that there is a state or threat of war involving the United States. Now, some people are concerned that that could be interpreted to apply to all communications, television, radio, and the Internet. And it can give a president a virtual kill switch for the Internet so that websites could be shut down or limited. We could see a president impeding access to certain websites and dealing in a partisan way as we go into an election. This is that loaded gun that Justice Jackson spoke about that's sitting on the table. And those are very serious powers. There are also economic powers that people don't know much about. The International Emergency Economic Powers Act allows for a variety of economic powers to be exercised. And Reagan and Clinton have done this in the past, as did George Bush in what was called Executive Order 13224, tying up bank accounts in the name of, in that case, resisting terrorism. The rhetoric can always be trotted out. We can always trot out threat of a national emergency, threat to our economy. And that's why this panoply of powers that it have existed and are now even more at the president's beck and call are very dangerous.
During a national emergency, Attorney Stephen Rohde, could Trump cancel or delay or interfere with the 2020 presidential election in November?
Well, I want to be very clear about that. And the answer is no. We should be very clear about what his powers are. The Constitution sets the limits on our election. And many people don't realize that the 20th Amendment says that the president and vice president's terms end 4 years after their election. So Trump and Pence are out if they are not sworn in, if a new president is not sworn in by January 20. And by succession, those powers, ironically, would fall to the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. So if they even attempt to toy with the presidential election, ironically, it would be Nancy Pelosi who is in succession next in line, because the Trump and Pence terms will expire by the Constitution. So there can be adjustments in the date of the election, but it all has to be accomplished in order for a new president to be sworn in on January 20. There are separate problems we have to face because individual states in our federalist system, ironically, the presidency is controlled by the Constitution, but individual state elections, even for a federal office, are controlled by the individual states. And I am very concerned and would expect governors to look ahead to November. They've got a few months while their legislatures may be convened, subject to social distancing, to look at what's called no-excuse mail-in absentee ballots. The no-excuse means you don't have to give an excuse, like a medical problem. Many states, the state of California where I live, have automatic mail-in ballots. And everybody that's listening to us today, and by extension to their families and friends, should immediately look to their state systems for mail-in ballots. In many states, they have the time between now and the November election to get those ballots once they are issued later in the fall. Because if we are all sheltering in place, then we can fill out our ballots at home and have someone mail them in. Although Trump cannot cancel the 2020 election, any combination of Republican governors and legislatures can tamp down the turnout in the election if they are not robust in providing creative and innovative solutions for how people can vote either in person with social distancing at the normal polling booths or by mail. And I think this is an election where we have to use our technology and our ability. Otherwise, I think, and this is worth a separate interview someday, it's simply people stepping up to exercise their franchise, to get out to vote, to get their friends out to vote, to help the elderly and the infirm and anyone who is cloistered in order to assist them in voting. And that's how our democracy is going to get through this.
We've been speaking with Attorney Stephen Rohde, a leader of the Civil Liberties Union out in California. Steve, under the John Warner National Defense Act of 2007, the president can send National Guard troops from one state to another without the permission of either governor of either state. I wanted to ask you what your thoughts are on that.
Yes, that is additional power that exists on the books already in the hands of an honest and respectful president. Those powers have been used in civil rights clashes, national emergencies, in hurricanes, and the like. What I worry about, in the name of, quote, protecting the country and protecting the November election, that the intimidating presence of National Guards and troops in and around polling areas, not to mention other areas in the country, could have a very intimidating impact on people. And it may be just enough to cause them not to vote. So I think those powers, again, are one of those loaded weapons. I think we have to be vigilant. And we have to be vigilant in everything we've talked about today, in communicating with our elected officials, in urging them to see the civil liberties risks that are endemic in this situation. This is true on a local, statewide, and national basis. The civil liberties concerns right now, how people who are incarcerated, the homeless, other vulnerable communities, these emergency powers are not confined to the president. All political leaders can exercise broad powers in the name of an emergency. And I think as much as we are glued to our televisions and worried about ourselves, the elderly, the infirm, and anyone who contracts this virus, when we speak of the health of this nation, the health of this nation depends on our Constitution, it depends on our laws, and it depends on the protection of our civil liberties. We cannot sacrifice any of those in the name of safety. We have to be prudent in how legitimate controls are used, but we also have to send up a red flag of the first sign that this president or any elected official abuses their authority. And I hope people will stay alert. They will react to the first sign of any of these abuses by contacting their legislatures and governors and elected officials, by organizing. This has given us a tremendous potential to organize, even if we are sheltering at home. I've had repeated Zoom meetings with the ACLU, with other organizations, to stay active. It's healthy to individuals to stay active. And if there's ever a time to be in touch with your elected officials from home, this is that time, because we've got to come through this with a strong country without having tattered and impaired our Constitution.
Well, that was beautifully articulated, Attorney Stephen Rohde. Thank you very much. We've come to an end of our allotted time, so I'm going to unfortunately have to say goodbye. But we will check in with you again as you follow these things, and we're very grateful to have you as a guest on Law and Disorder. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you for devoting time to this and to all the issues you always do. I appreciate it.
You take it easy, Steve. Bye-bye.
Be safe.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. United States presidents have the discretion to declare a national emergency. As soon as they do, they can sidestep many existing limits to presidential authority. In fact, 136 or more special provisions become available. Some of these provisions give reasonable responses to real emergencies, while others seem to bolster the power of a so-called unitary executive who wants to amass or retain power. The president can activate laws allowing him to, for example, shut down many kinds of electronic communications inside the U.S., or freeze Americans' bank accounts,
Other powers are available without a declaration of emergency, including laws that allow the president to deploy troops inside the country to quell domestic unrest. The rationale for having emergency powers is simple. The government's ordinary powers may not be enough in times of crisis. Amending the laws to provide greater ones would just take too long. Emergency powers are intended to give a temporary boost until the emergency passes or there is time to change the law through the regular legislative process. The problem comes when presidents don't have the best interest of the country in mind. Joining us to discuss emergency presidential powers is Andrew Boyd, counsel at the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program. Andrew spent 7 years prosecuting senior Khmer Rouge leaders on behalf of the United Nations for war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. He also worked on cases resulting from the 1994 Rwandan genocide at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. Andrew Boyd, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Andrew, what does the U.S. Constitution say about what rights a president may suspend during national emergency?
Actually, the U.S. Constitution itself doesn't give the president any right to suspend the rights of citizens during national emergencies. The Constitution is very sparse in its discussion of emergency powers, but it does discuss emergency powers in one place, in Article 1, and it talks about the ability to suspend habeas corpus, the ability of someone who has been arrested to challenge that arrest before an impartial judiciary, but that is ascribed to Congress, not to the president.
Underlying emergency presidential powers is the assumption that the chief executive will act in the country's best interest. What if a president declares an emergency because he faces something like impeachment or he just wants to retain his power?
That's right. That type of situation would be an abuse of powers that many countries have given to the executive to use in times of true emergencies. Because emergencies are difficult to predict, legislatures will often say that they want an executive to have certain powers that they wouldn't ordinarily have for a short amount of time to deal with those emergencies, and they have to pass those laws in advance because the idea is there may not be time to pass those laws when the emergency actually happens. It does rely on a certain amount of good faith exercise by the president. In the past, that has mostly been true, although not entirely. But when you have a president who is blatantly willing to use these powers in circumstances that do not constitute an emergency, there's a clear concern about circumventing of checks and balances that undergird our entire democracy.
Well, let's talk about what is an emergency. For example, is there an emergency situation now at our southern border, as Trump sought to convince the American people the other night? Is that an emergency that he could use to declare a state of emergency?
Well, that is what he is threatening to do. I think objectively, factually, it's pretty clear that the immigration situation does not constitute an emergency for quite a number of reasons. First of all, illegal immigration across the southern border is at historic lows when you look back at recent years. In addition, it hasn't been a sudden change in immigration. Immigration is an issue that has been debated for years now, and including in the last Congress, where Congress also declined to provide President Trump with the funding that he requested for building the wall. Indeed, the very fact that the president has been so blatantly clear that he would use emergency powers only if he couldn't get the wall funded through Congress itself speaks to the fact that this is not an unforeseen emergency that's going to pop up suddenly. It's that he's trying to use these powers or would potentially use these powers to get around Congress and Congress's power of the purse, and that would not be appropriate under the spirit, certainly, of the National Emergencies Act, which is the governing law.
Well, in addition to getting money for building his wall, what other things might Trump do if he declares a state of emergency?
Oh, sure. Well, so the here at the Brennan Center, we've done a fair amount of research on emergency powers. The president has the access to over 136 particular laws once he declares a national emergency, or whether once a national emergency is declared. Something over 90 of those are available to him simply by him declaring a national emergency. Some other ones require an additional step for that to occur. And these emergencies run the gamut. And I should mention that President Trump has already declared at least three national emergencies during his term, and other presidents have declared national emergencies as well. There are currently 31 national emergencies actually in effect, which is something that many people don't realize, and these use various aspects of these powers. But some of the scariest powers that are available to the president when he declares a national emergency include the ability to seize radio stations, the ability to sanction individuals, including American persons within the United States, prohibiting them from having bank accounts or earning money, and even testing of biological and chemical weapon persons. So there are some scary powers out there that a president could potentially use if he was so inclined.
Andrew, how does he actually do this? Does he issue a directive declaring an emergency, and is that public information that we could look for somewhere?
Yes, it is. Under the National Emergencies Act, which was passed in 1976, the president is required to declare a national emergency, to transmit that declaration to Congress, and to post it in the Federal Register. And the National Emergencies Act of 1976, although it is fairly bare bones and we would argue is ripe for Congress to revisit and revise to place greater controls on national emergencies, was actually enacted at the time because of concerns over executive abuse of emergency powers. At the time, prior to the National Emergencies Act, the president had a lot of leeway to declare a national emergency and not a lot of transparency. As soon as he declared a national emergency, he had access to over 400 powers, statutory powers, and he didn't have to say which ones he was using or how he was using them. And so Congress said, okay, enough of that. We're going to put some more procedural requirements on you, including the necessity for you to publicly declare this, place it in the Federal Register, but also tell us which of the particular powers you're going to use under this national emergency. So the president has to say, I declare a national emergency, and I'm going to use such and such statutory code that enables me to do X, Y, and Z.
I read about something called presidential emergency action documents. Can you talk about those briefly? I heard that Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North may have actually worked with FEMA in the past to control the U.S., to have it turned over to FEMA during a national crisis. What are those action documents, and are those available to the public?
If I may, I'll take it from the back end, because while I'm certainly interested in learning more about the presidential emergency action documents or directives, they, as far as I know, and as far as my research has turned up in our research at the Brennan Center, none of those have ever been made public, even though they have been there have been versions of them since sometime in the 1950s, and they are continuously updated, possibly to this day, certainly up through the last administration, because we see them referenced in various documents. For example, in budget submissions that the Department of Justice has submitted to Congress, they talk about the Office of Legal Counsel being engaged in a project to update presidential emergency active directives. And what these documents are, as far as we can gather from the outside, is a series of executive orders and other types of orders that are ready to go in certain types of emergencies, whereby the president can exercise powers. Now, what powers he is claiming he can exercise under those, we don't know, because these documents are classified and none have ever been made public. In the past, we know that there have been descriptions of these documents which have talked about people on lists that would be automatically arrested if these documents were utilized. So there's potentially some very scary stuff in there. You know, there's other than internal executive branch analysis, we don't know how much executive presidential power they claim to be exercising, whether they would be upheld in courts or not during a time of emergency. So it's certainly an area that we think more transparency is necessary.
What scares me is the possibility that the president could deploy armed forces, American troops, inside of this country, do what they call law and order. I'm thinking, what if there was a huge social upheaval in this country? Could the president call out the American Army or the Marines to enforce his will?
Well, there are some restrictions on that. There is a law dating from the Civil War, the post-Civil War era, called the Posse Comitatus Act, which prohibits the use of American military domestically to engage in law enforcement. There are exceptions to that and some ways around that. For example, as you may be aware, the president, including in his State of the Union address, discussed the deployment of troops to the southern border. Those troops are not subject to the Posse Comitatus Act under the view of the administration because they are not engaged in law enforcement. For example, they are reportedly engaged in building fences and providing potentially medical aid and support to Department of Homeland Security forces that are at the border, but they're not themselves engaged in law enforcement and therefore don't fall under the Posse Comitatus Act. However, there are other laws, such as the Insurrection Act, which would allow the president, under certain circumstances, ostensibly, to use the military to put down insurrection within the United States as defined under that act. That's certainly another area where a bad faith actor could potentially abuse those powers, and another area where we think Congress should revisit and potentially place greater checks.
Andrew, talk about economic powers during an emergency. Can the president shut down the assets of individuals and organizations? And I'm assuming, since we know there are lists of people who might be targeted, that could be a venue he pursues?
That's correct. The president does have that power under an act called the International Emergency Economic Powers Act. And in fact, that act, for short, which is called IEPA, is the most commonly used emergency power by any president since the National Emergencies Act was passed in 1976. It has been used in all except for a couple of the over 50 declared emergencies that presidents have declared since that time. Mostly, however, it is used in regards to persons outside of the United States. So, for example, sometimes it's even used in relation to alleged human rights abusers in other countries in order to seize their assets. However, it has been used in the past to target individuals within the United States. And the powers under this act are so broad that it could essentially economically paralyze someone, prohibit them from being able to earn money or receive money in any way that would allow them to buy food or to rent an apartment, et cetera, et cetera. The use of these powers within the United States obviously raises tremendous due process concerns under the Constitution for the ability to challenge these types of sanctions in court and to see what evidence is being used against an individual. And in fact, it was challenged, and in a couple of federal court cases, judges have raised these due process concerns and said, you know, the application of these laws within the United States without the proper due process measures raises serious constitutional issues. However, once judges started raising these issues, past administrations backed down from using them within the United States, so it never reached the Supreme Court.
We're speaking with Attorney Andrew Boyd from the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program. Andrew, I wanted to ask you if you're aware of the lawsuit that Noam Chomsky and Chris Hedges brought here in New York back in 2016. In federal court, Judge Catherine Forrest heard it, and it was brought to challenge the National Defense Authorization Act, Section 1021, which allows for the use of the president to use troops domestically for law enforcement within the United States. Forrest heard witnesses, and she declared in favor of Hedges and Chomsky, whereupon the government sought to appeal the case to the Court of Appeals. Before the Court of Appeals could hear it, the attorneys for Chomsky and Hedges went down to D.C. and they spoke with Nancy Pelosi, and they said, if you'll remove the powers of the president to rendition American citizens and put them away forever, if you'll take that out of the law, we'll drop the lawsuit. And Pelosi said no, she wouldn't do it. And Chris Hedges concluded from that they know what's coming. And I wanted to know if you were aware of this and what your thoughts are on it.
I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with that lawsuit. It would be difficult for me to comment on it.
Well, let's move along.
Andrew, we've heard talk of the president using the so-called kill switch to curtail internet access. Do you think that is a possibility if he declares an emergency?
So the interpretation of the section of the Communications Act, some persons within the administration have alleged give them the power that would potentially give them the power to take or seize control of parts of the internet. You know, that's an interpretation that hasn't, to my knowledge, been fully challenged in court, and it's an interpretation based off of laws that predate the internet. I should also mention it's not explicitly an emergency power. That is, that particular power that potentially could give a president or that some interpret to give the president power to control the internet is a power that is available through a declaration of the potential for war, not through a national emergency declaration. But that is some small comfort, because obviously a president who's willing to abuse national emergency powers might also be willing to abuse those types of powers. And clearly, we see this in foreign countries where persons who feel their power is being threatened control parts of the internet, because the internet is obviously a huge aspect of political campaigns, of communication campaigns, and things like that.
What concerns me is what the Supreme Court might do. Let's say that Trump does call a national emergency. The matter is quickly brought in front of the Supreme Court with the addition of Kavanaugh and Justice Neil Gorsuch on the Supreme Court. You have people that are inclined to give a wide berth to executive authority and executive power. Does that concern you, Andrew?
It absolutely does. The federal judiciary is typically very deferential to the executive when they are dealing with issues of national defense, national emergency. So that would be one aspect of any such case that would surround this. We've also seen just last term that the Supreme Court in the Trump v. Hawaii case, which is also referred to as the Muslim ban case, and this was the Supreme Court before Justice Kavanaugh joined, was willing to look past statements that the president had made that clearly indicated his true motivation for the particular executive act that was being challenged, and they were willing to take on face value administration claims regarding the processes that they went through in order to determine which countries should not be, persons from which countries should not be granted visas. You have a somewhat similar situation here, where the president is clearly telegraphing that he would be using emergency powers in a way that they were not supposed to be used, in a way to sort of get around Congress's power of the purse. But the question is, you know, would the Supreme Court consider those statements and those tweets from the president, or would they just look at whatever the Department of Justice puts up there and says is the reasoning behind the use of the national emergency powers? And, you know, what would actually happen is anyone's guess. So I should also mention that any legal challenge to a declaration of national emergency and specifically to try to obtain money to build the wall would not only focus on whether the national emergency declaration was appropriate, but also whether the particular statutory powers that the president is claiming to use to move money around, whether those are being used in an appropriate way.
Andrew Boyd, it's really been a pleasure, albeit a slightly disturbing one, to have you join us on Law and Disorder. And we thank you and your colleagues for your excellent work in this field.